From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. Happy New Year. I thought I'd start the New Year outright with Wendy Murphy, a couple of articles that she's written for the Patriot Ledger, one on the Sandy Hook shooting and another one on the jogger case, and no better person to start out with. Happy New Year, Wendy.
Hey, Happy New Year to you too, Dana. I'm glad to be here again.
I promise that I won't start a petition to have you deported to Canada tonight. Isn't that crazy? But anyway, listen, since we've had you on the show last, lots of stuff going on. One of the things that happened, and we all wish that it hadn't happened, and we can analyze the bejesus out of it until the cows come home, is the shooting in Connecticut. But what caught my eye is your article for the Patriot Ledger for, I think it was December 17th. About the motive. Now, right now we're hearing lots about Holmes and the Colorado shooting, and they're talking about motive. This case, they're not talking about any of that. Why?
Well, that's the question I ask in my piece, Dana, and I think the silence is both deafening and very important. And the quieter officials are about the motive, the more the public should demand full access to the truth. Because, look, you know, we can use the horrific situation as a reason to debate guns and gun ownership and sure, gun regulations, and that's fine. I'm not opposed to that. But we have to be careful not to let that debate distract us or mask the fundamental question, which is why was Adam Lanza so angry? Why was he so rageful? What was it that provoked him to not only kill human beings, but particularly young ones of a certain age in a certain school at a certain time? If we don't get an answer to that, then we live in a very sick country. And we do live in a sick country for, you know, lots of folks might argue that that's not news. But for something of this magnitude, for the truth not to come out, I think speaks so ill of what is left of the integrity of our democracy. The public has a profound right to know, not only because the nature of the event was tremendously meaningful to people and it had a tremendous impact on people and their feelings, but also because it affects our thoughts about the world we live in. Is it safe? What policies and laws should we be talking about changing? And we can't fix the problem and stop that from happening again if we limit the debate to gun regulation.
Right.
So here's an interesting couple of points about why I'm very suspicious and why I wish the entire world that's been paying attention. This is not just a national, but it's a global story, news story. Why are people not clamoring for full disclosure of the truth? If anywhere, it's happening on the internet, and thankfully, people, you know, good folks who believe in the public's right to know are using social media and the internet to demand more information. But keep in mind that the reason I've been provoked to ask tougher questions is because, like a lot of folks, I was glued to the television set when the news first broke, the matter was first being discussed by officials, and they said, quote, "We have very good evidence of motive. Very good. We found very good evidence of motive." And two or three days later, that storyline was gone, and folks were saying things like, "We may never know. We got to the home and the hard drive was destroyed, so we can't really get information, and we just have to put this on the back burner. We don't know. It could be months. We've got to work on it, and it's all mysterious, and we just don't know." And, you know, a couple of red flags there for me, Dana, and for a lot of folks. Number one, how did we go from very good evidence of motive to no evidence of motive? How did we how did we all get suckered into to accepting, or some people got suckered in, not me, accepting the claim that because the hard drive had been damaged with what was reportedly a hammer or a screwdriver, which is sort of silly when you think about it. The guy had weapons, huge weapons. Why would, if he wanted to destroy a hard drive, I don't think, you know, you'd whack it with a hammer if you had a machine gun, a virtual machine gun anyway. And so my real concern was, so what if the hard drive is destroyed? They know his ISP address.
Yeah.
They know how to decode and unpack and examine and determine and find absolutely everything that guy has ever done on the Internet, ever. So to suggest that because the hard drive had a ding in it from a hammer, or let's say it really was destroyed, that has nothing to do with whether they can learn things about his activities on the Internet. And unlike, you know, with John Holmes in the Aurora, Colorado case, they're just unwavering silence and refusal to answer questions when you pit it against the enormous amount of information that has come out about John Holmes, which was deeply personal information. You know, what kind of psychiatric problems he had, what did he say to his therapist? There were people saying, boy, should we really know all this, because this is privileged information, doctor, patient, psychologist, therapist, patient privilege. And we all said we should know it because of the nature of what he did and so forth. Well, my goodness, how do we know nothing about the Adam Lanza situation? It makes no sense. And so, you know, I've gotten to the point, and I wrote this article saying, you're not going to get away with telling us nothing. It's just not going to work. And by the way, can we please have some more information about the guns? You know, the mama owned guns.
Yeah.
That included weapons, roughly speaking, akin to nothing I've ever heard of as a quote-unquote enthusiast description of guns, what an enthusiast would have. Nothing I've ever heard of would match up with the kind of weapon she had. She had a virtual arsenal, and if you ask anybody in law enforcement, she had the kinds of weapons law enforcement officials and the military are assigned when they're on the battlefield and need that high degree of self-protection and assault weapons because they're trying to kill enemies and so forth. She had the weapons that you see in the homes of major drug dealers. Why?
Yeah.
Why? You can't expect the public to believe that she had those weapons because she was an enthusiast. One of them was literally the kind of assault weapon that, even if you put the maximum magazine in it, which it should have carried 30 bullets at a time in the magazine that goes with the gun, which is legal, it had 100 bullets in the magazine. That's not even a legal magazine. You can't have 100 bullets that in a semi-automatic of that size lawfully. So what kind of enthusiast was she that she would, you know, that's way past enthusiasm. And it's annoying. On a very deep level, it's annoying that there isn't a mounting, you know, I don't know, public outcry for more information. When 20 little defenseless, totally innocent six-year-olds are slaughtered, and not to mention the teachers and even his own mother, when all those people are slaughtered and we never get an answer to why, that there's something wrong. That is not democracy. I don't know what it is, but fascism, totalitarianism, authoritarian, it is not democracy.
Well, you know, the simple thing is to try and figure out what went wrong is an easy way to try and make it right. And politicizing the gun control issue, is it a mental health issue? Is it? And you make a very good point about the mother and the type of weapons that she had. What about law enforcement in this case? The case, we know who the shooter was. There's, you know, keeping evidence close to the vest if there was another suspect or something is understandable. But what about law enforcement? Do you think they're getting pressure to tighten up on this?
You know, they must be, because the silence otherwise makes no sense. Somebody somewhere is saying, we got to hold this in. You know, the Internet is abuzz with some interesting information that the public is learning from public sources, but it isn't being broadcast, at least on mainstream news, which is that the car at the scene, presumably the one Lanza drove to the scene with weapons in the trunk, was owned by a man whose last name is Rodia, R-O-D-I-A. Rodia, is, according to the accounts on the internet news sources, a convicted drug dealer. Why was his car at the scene? Why was Lanza in that car? Why? It's a fair question. If that's whose car he was driving and the guy's a convicted drug dealer, why can't the public have an answer to the question, why was Lanza driving the car or in the car? I don't know if there were other people involved, but why the silence on other people's involvement? Why no explanation for how he knew a guy named Philip Rodia? And how does that connect, if at all, to his mother? These guns and the guns are so unusual, and it's such a big red flag. Those guns are so unusual that not to have anybody really take up the task of helping the public put their head around this kind of monstrous act, I think is going to destroy us because, number one, we are not going to trust government officials. And we already have a problem with the lack of trust for government officials in this country. We right. already have a growing, whether it's Waco or, Oklahoma City bombing, you've got a lot of people in this country who don't trust the government. The degree of secrecy in this case that's mounting in something so massive that affects regular people, this is not like some major CIA operative doing stuff God knows where in connection with whatever national security issue might. This is a bunch of first graders slaughtered. And, to treat this as if the public doesn't have a right to know, I think, is to expose the country's integrity to great ridicule. And frankly, it's going to make us not only more disdainful and dubious and skeptical about our government and our government's actions and the things they tell us. We're not going to believe them. We're going to stop believing. We already have a lot of people who don't believe them. We're going to have more people not believing them. And they're going to be regular, everyday people who send their kids to school starting to say things like, I don't think I should trust that government official when that government official tells me this is good for me, my family, my children, and so forth. You can't expect a healthy democracy to thrive in the midst of such cynicism. And cynicism is going to be the byproduct of the silence.
Wendy Murphy's here. You can click on the link in the show notes to read the Patriot Ledger articles on the Connecticut massacre and the Central Park jogger case. Wendy, what about the civil aspect here? Some will say that everything is hushed up because there's the potential for lawsuits and, best be quiet and be careful rather than get yourself in trouble by talking. What about that?
Yeah, and I do suggest that that's a possible explanation for the silence in my piece. If they're that worried about the civil lawsuit, then they will clamp down. And the government would be the defendant. When you sue a school for failing to protect a child, you're really suing the government, the state. So the employees of the state, which include police and so forth and other law enforcement officials, would all be on the same team, if you will, and interested in helping to keep the liability exposure down. Interestingly, Dana, and your audience probably knows this, a civil lawsuit was filed right. by a child on behalf of a child who survived. And within days, the lawsuit was withdrawn without explanation, or I should say without rational explanation. That's creepy, too. That is creepy, too, because one of the ways to force government officials to reveal more information is to file a lawsuit and, through the process of discovery and so forth, come to understand more about exactly what happened and why. So for that lawsuit to have been withdrawn in the matter of days, which is really unheard of. I've been a lawyer for a long time. That's just not how the business works. You don't file a lawsuit and then just withdraw it. But, the notion that they're doing this because they want to prevent civil lawsuits is an interesting question. Like a lot of people, I heard originally that he got in because he was buzzed in. He got into the school
right.
very easily. They didn't use the security that they had. My reaction when I heard that they had super-duper security at the school was, why? Why on earth in the middle of rural Connecticut? And I've been to that region. I was there not too long ago, actually. It's a very, sort of quiet town in the middle of nowhere. Very rural is maybe too much of a description, but something around, I would call it more rural, certainly, than urban, far more rural than urban. You don't see schools in lockdown with, you know, bulletproof doors and security codes and all this stuff. I'm not sure they had bulletproof doors. Clearly, he got in. But why did they do that? So I'm inferring from the fact that a school that shouldn't have that kind of security put in that kind of security really close in time to this incident may have been concerned, may have been on alert, may have been warned in some fashion that there was danger, that this guy had made threats, for example, in the past, and maybe that's part of what they're not telling us, because they know damn well that if this guy made threats and that school knew and they did not take effective steps to protect the kids, which is clear because why? The kids are dead. That's a hundreds of millions of dollars in a lawsuit. That's what that's worth. But, you know, making a big secret out of it, I'm not sure it's going to save them much money, because the lawsuits will be filed eventually by some people at some time. And maybe the secrecy is because they're all going to work out a deal and give the families a bunch of money and not go through the rigors of a lawsuit. The insurance companies ultimately would have to make that decision. But that could be that could be why so many of the families aren't speaking out. I mean, it's amazing how few families have spoken out. And I'm told that each of the families has a state trooper posted at their house right. to protect them. Protect them from what?
Yeah.
From asking tough questions, from having a chance to say out loud how they feel and what they're angry about, and using their voices to demand that the public get full access to information. So I don't know, Dana. I think, I think that if nothing truthful comes out about this ever, it will reverberate. Silence can reverberate. It reverberates deeply. It reverberates in ways that are sometimes hard to predict. But it can change an entire culture when the culture feels distrustful of its own government. All kinds of bad things can follow.
For sure. Wendy Murphy's here. In January 5th, 2013, her article for the Patriot Ledger, there's a new movie about the Central Park jogger rape case, and we know about that case. And Wendy's asking the question, is it about money and not innocence? Let's talk about that. What's going on there?
Yeah, so there's a new film out by a pretty acclaimed filmmaker named Ken Burns,
right.
Who has done a film about the Central Park jogger case that he describes the five men who pled guilty in that case and confessed to the crime. I'm sorry, they didn't plead guilty. They confessed and then were found guilty at trial. He's claiming they're innocent. And he makes two central points in the film. One is that the five young men who confessed were coerced to confess by police who browbeat them and, you know, made them confess falsely. And that a man who confessed years later to the crime acted alone. And the reason that claim is being accepted by a lot of folks is because, indeed, that man, Matias Reyes is his name, did say publicly and in official documents that he did commit the rape and that he acted alone. He beat her and raped her and acted alone. Police have they've been sued for sort of, you know, coercing the confessions, and they are absolutely refusing to settle because they've proved in court already that nothing they did was coercive, that the confessions were not at all coerced, that the kids, they were 14 to 16 years old at the time, that the young men, I don't want to call them kids, you could argue that the 14-year-olds were young enough to call kids, but the younger ones, the ones who were under 16, all had parents or family members with them every single time they spoke to the cops, every time, including during the confessions, which, by the way, were videotaped and reduced to writing and signed. Each of the five guys gave information they could not have known had they not been there. They separately confessed. They implicated each other. One guy described that the victim's Walkman was stolen, and, you know, yet they claim the cops told them about the evidence so that they would confess credibly. Well, the guy who said that the victim's Walkman had been stolen told police that at a time when cops had no way of knowing there was even a Walkman involved, because the victim was beaten so badly she was rendered unconscious and didn't come out of her coma for months. So they had no idea she even had a Walkman, much less that it was stolen. Those are the kinds of details that matter. And these same guys who confessed, who are now claiming they didn't do it and that the confessions were beaten out of them, basically, they also made statements to friends. And those friends testified at trial. You know that woman who got raped in the park last night? That was us. Oh, you should, you know, and we raped, we beat this woman, we made a woman bleed. And another guy was looking at the crime scene and talking about, oh, look at all that blood. Wow, I didn't realize we had beaten her this badly. I knew she was bleeding, but I didn't know there was this much blood. So many statements they made outside of the context of the confessions that are also admissions and inculpatory statements that you can't just explain away and say, oh, the cops browbeat them. There's absolutely no evidence that the cops did anything but respect their constitutional rights, have parents there where the law required it. The law didn't require parents to be there if they were 16 or older.
Right.
And, you know, they asked them questions about what happened, and they told what happened. Now, here's the interesting thing about the guy who claimed to have acted alone. Police knew there was police knew there was DNA on the victim's body that didn't match any of the five guys who confessed. So they always knew there was at least a sixth man involved, but they wouldn't tell. They either didn't know because he came onto the scene after the fact, or he was an older guy, this Matias Reyes. And they were, you know, he's a known criminal, and they were probably afraid to identify him, afraid that he'd kill them. And, you know, 40 kids, 40 guys entered the park around the time the victim did that night, and they said they all got there to do some wilding, which meant to beat and rob people, beat them up and rob them. And that included these five guys. Well, these five guys admitted to other crimes that night involving other victims in the same area where the victim was beaten and raped. And they said those confessions were correct. So I don't know how you're confessing to one crime, 100 feet away, and the police got that one correctly. But this one you're claiming they coerced out of you makes no sense. But this man who claimed to have acted alone, this is an interesting part of the story. He, in 2002, so this crime goes back to 1989. DNA technology didn't exist yet, but cops knew there was semen on the victim's body that didn't match any of the guys. The technology they did have could tell them that it didn't match any of the guys who confessed. So they knew there was a sixth guy. Well, flash ahead, 2002, DNA exists now. The technology testing exists. One of the five who confessed was in prison with Matias Reyes around the time the DNA tests were being done, and they talked about the crime. The next thing you know, Reyes says, they do the test, they find Reyes's DNA, and Reyes says, yep, it was mine, I acted alone, nobody else was with me. Now, the cops believe that he was either threatened in prison by that man, his name was Kerry Wise, he was one of the five who confessed. He was either threatened or offered money.
Yep.
Maybe connected to the $250 million lawsuit. He was offered something to falsely claim that he acted alone. But we know that he didn't act alone. We know 100% that he was not the sole actor for a host of reasons. And the only reason this lawsuit has been filed is because there are people who are willing to look at what is clear, look at confessions that are credible, look at the evidence objectively, look at the videotaped confessions and understand the strength of the case. They're willing to turn a blind eye to all that stuff. You know why? And a lot of the newspapers out there and a lot of the mainstream media are supporting this film because $250 million is on the line. They have been pressuring the New York City Police Department and their lawyers to settle the case, to give them a ton of money. And to the credit of the cops and the credit of the lawyers involved in the case, on behalf of the New York City cops who did the right thing and got good confessions, solid confessions, not coerced confessions, to their credit, they're saying, we don't care how many damn films you make, we don't care if you're a good film director or a crappy filmmaker, Ken Burns or Joe Schmo, you're not getting a dime out of us. You may be entitled to a new trial, and that's an interesting point. After the DNA came out, the judge reversed their convictions, and overturned their convictions on the grounds that DNA technology hadn't been around and that they would have been able to use the evidence had the technology been around back in 1989. Okay, you reverse their convictions because the evidence wasn't available technologically back then. That's fine. You do not give them one dime, much less $250 million. It's disgusting. It's propaganda. And the public's money is on the line.
Absolutely. Wendy, always a pleasure. And listeners, click on the link in the show notes for this article and the other. Happy New Year, ma'am. We'll talk to you soon.
And back at you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's Wendy Murphy, a former prosecutor. And she makes a good point. The article ends this way. New DNA tests may have justified granting the defendants a new trial, but the public doesn't owe them a dime, much less hundreds of millions of dollars. I don't know. Is this going to be another Memphis case? We're going to take a break, and we'll be back here in a minute on the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio with Drew Kesey to talk about Jennifer Kesey, his missing daughter. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. This coming January 24th, 2013, Jennifer Kesey has been missing through the act of abduction. Now, it's been 7 years. Hard to believe it's been that long. Now, I talked about Jennifer on my commentary the other day, and I've had her dad, Drew, on the show many times, and I want to bring Drew back on tonight to talk about Jennifer. Drew, welcome back to the program.
Good evening, Dana. Thank you for having me.
It's 7 years. It's been a seven-year nightmare for you.
Yeah, it is that.
It's hard to believe that 7 years. And I know time has probably stopped for Joyce and yourself and your family since that day. But what's been going on? What's been going on as far as the investigation goes? I told you a long time ago we covered it from the get-go, and we're going to keep covering it until you get the answers you deserve. But everyone's curious what's been happening.
Well, I thank you, first of all, for sticking with her and us. I wish I could say things were progressing. It's hard to sit here at 7 years and basically say that we are no closer to finding Jennifer, and that is pretty much the truth. We have just ventured into our 14th investigative team in that 7 years, and Orlando Police Department still think that they are going to solve Jennifer's disappearance. We do have leads that come in, what we are told now, on pretty much a weekly basis, but continue to come in to this day. And we fight back and forth with police, trying to make the case cold. But they say that they have too many things to work on and work through. But unfortunately, Dana, we are no closer than the day she went missing.
It's interesting when you say that, and people may not understand, when you say that you're trying to get the police to make the case go cold. Explain that if you could, please.
Sure. Through the education that unfortunately you receive when you're in situations like this, you learn quite quickly where your help is, where your resources are, and where your money is at, especially within governmental and law enforcement agencies. And we wish to make Jennifer's case cold because of the fact that there are many, many resources on a national basis that could, I believe, help. Number two, there is, believe it or not, cold case money out there just waiting to be used, and it doesn't put a burden on a department like Orlando Police Department. And, you know, most importantly, they don't have to share anything until it's a cold case. They don't have to talk to us. They will not let a private investigator in. They will not let myself or anyone in my family read any files. So there's a huge difference if we can get the case to be cold. But so far, unfortunately, short of, I guess, bringing lawyers in or what have you, which we have the money to do, they rule a case, and they truly believe that they are going to someday solve the case. I think that would be dumb luck.
Well, you know, someday, and this has been 7 years, I can remember having you on the program early on in the investigation, and, I'm not going to say broken promises, but I'm going to say blank promises of solving a case is an easy out for a law enforcement agency to do. And if the resources are there and making the case cold, like you say, brings in other agencies, etc., have you hired a private investigator or a private investigator doing any work on this case?
No, we have not. If we cannot get into
the files,
if you know, there were so many leads coming in at one point that we didn't handle all of them, obviously.
Right.
There's been over 1,400 leads. There's been so much that has happened. That if we can't get into the files, there's honestly no sense. I could spend a small fortune,
sure,
trying to catch a PI up on the first year, let alone even probably the first 3 months. To me, at least, it seems to be quite counterproductive. Someone who's just going to be stonewalled.
Exactly. Exactly.
But the law is on their side. They don't have to speak to anyone. Period.
Drew Kessie's here talking about his daughter Jennifer Kessie, who's been missing for 7 years now. I encourage you to go to findjenniferkessie.com. Kessie is spelled K-E-S-S-E. Let's go back to 7 years ago, January 24th. And I know you've done this many times, Drew, and I apologize for asking again, but the last time you spoke to Jennifer?
Last time I spoke to Jennifer, well, I remember a few of the last times, actually.
Right.
The last time I spoke to her was basically the night that she came home, Monday night, January 23rd, approximately 6:30-ish in the evening. And she was telling me about her trip. She had just come back the night before from a four-day trip with her boyfriend to St. Croix. They flew. They did not take a cruise ship. And she came back from St. Croix, stayed at her boyfriend's house in Fort Lauderdale, got up the morning of January 23rd, went to work, came home after work, spoke to myself, my wife, my son, a few of her best friends, and then her boyfriend at 10 p.m., and said she was very tired and she's going to sleep. She had an early day the next day, Tuesday morning being the 23rd, at which she did not make it to work. We were contacted by her work that morning, 2 hours or so after she should have been to work, simply asking, was anything wrong? Jennifer did not show up, and that was very unusual. And that's when her hell and our hell started.
Yeah.
It was approximately 10:15 in the morning on January 24th. It was a Tuesday, 2006. And really from January 23rd at 10 p.m. when she said goodnight to her boyfriend, Rob, we don't know what happened. We do know that her shower was wet. She had clothes laid out on her bed. Her towel was wet. And nothing else in her condo, which she had lived in only 2 months to the day, was touched. Her bag that she went away on vacation was right inside her front door. It was, because it was new and we held her to her condo or home.
Right.
Everything was in place. Nothing was touched. It was just the bathroom and the bedroom, like, okay, I'm home, got to get up, got to go to work. So I truly believe that either something happened right at the door or she did not make it to her car going out to work.
Right.
Tuesday, January 24th.
Drew Kessie's here. When early on, I know I've seen the media coverage. Like I say, you've been on my program many times. Print media, television, radio, everything has been out there. What about the media? What more can we do?
I think awareness still is everything. It's very hard to keep Jennifer anywhere in the limelight now. A lot of folks think that they found her, you know, dead. A lot of folks think that we've just given up as a family, and
right.
We definitely, that's just will never happen and can't happen. It's just a tough thing that I don't know what to say, Dan.
It's difficult, and you know, I don't expect you to say much more than what you've already said and that you've been saying for the last 7 years. Keeping the story alive is, and I'm not trying to play on words, because we all hope and pray that Jennifer, you and I talked about it, that we'd have her on the show. But now it's been 7 years, and this case needs to go cold. The authorities need to do something to get some answers. What happened to her? Did she make it to her car? Did it happen at her doorstep? Again, go to the website. There's posters. There's all sorts of information.
Also, just to bring this in, we still have a person who we have on film on the website.
Right. And I was just
not too far off, 1 mile down the road, walked away, never looking back, and we cannot find that person either.
I was just going to mention the surveillance video, the security video, whatever you wanted to call it, is there too. It's so tough, Drew, to wrap my head around the fact that the Orlando Police Department won't make this case go cold. Have they ever told you what the criteria is to have a case cold?
Yes. That is to have exhausted all leads and all options on any lead and any information concerning Jennifer's case. And we were told, I guess about 2 months ago now, maybe a little over that, that there's probably between 11 and 13 things that still have to be worked on, of which I told them quite blankly, what the hell's taking you so damn long?
Exactly.
And it's just all the same stuff we keep hearing. And I don't mean to come down on them, but, you know, this is like a broken record in a lot of missing persons cases.
Yeah.
So Jennifer's case is not just, you know, the only one that this happens to. In fact, it's commonplace in missing persons cases. But they have, you know, like I've had discussions with the chief, and I'm like, you have to understand where we are coming from at this point. Every single resource possible to her, Jennifer, needs to be utilized, not at your discretion. It needs to be utilized at this point. And we just don't see that. They don't see that. They feel that they have things, as I said, continually to work on, to the point where they've always had detectives working the case, and they work it every week for 7 years. But to me, I'm like, you've had your chance. You've had your chance, and we've had these discussions.
Yeah, no, exactly. Drew Kessy is here, and we're talking about his daughter, Jennifer. Go to the website, www.findjenniferkessy.com. Keeping the story going, bringing not only this story but other stories about the missing is so important, and I know you've done work advocacy work in the state with government trying to change the laws or bring in new laws, so to speak. Let's talk about those a little bit.
We've tried to do as much as possible to help the situation. After you go through this and continue to go through it, you see things that need to be changed. The first was really creating a missing persons law that made sense. Not only in the state of Florida, but it's basically the law in, I guess, around 40 states now, the basis of the law. And that's enhancing this child instead of adults, people who need help, things such as that. So we have an enhanced missing persons law here that has helped many since Jennifer has gone. It did not help Jennifer whatsoever. Secondly, would be out of the missing persons law, the Jennifer Kessy Tiffany Sessions Missing Persons Act, actually, in the state of Florida. Our governor was able to enact the Silver Alert, which is just like the Amber Alert for young children who go missing, but this is for older people, people with dementia, things such as that.
Sure. Yeah.
And we've actually had 100% recovery rate in the state of Florida with that law, and it's used about 100 times more than the Amber Alert in Florida being God's waiting room here. Outside of that, then our family was threatened. Our lives were threatened. There was not a strong enough state threat law so we changed that law and enhanced that law so anyone using electronic means to threaten, believe it or not, it was not against the law. Now it is, and it is a felony. And lastly, we enhanced the DNA upon felony arrest instead of conviction. And this has really helped cut crime. I don't know how much, but it has helped cut crime in the fact that the time between a first-time felon is arrested and convicted for that felony, he or she commits, on average, 5.5 more felonies. By taking the DNA upon arrest, we get to see all the other crimes that this person has committed if they leave behind DNA.
Right.
It has been collected. And that has helped tremendously with just overall crime rates and finding the miscreants out there that are really in a low percentage, but really ruin our society. And that's what we try and do. I don't know. You get an education, I'll tell you that much, of what's lacking, what's needed, what comes along with the laws and society as we evolve and what doesn't. What totally doesn't make sense, not having laws, and what we do make laws. So it's weird.
Well, Drew, I can tell you this, and I've told you many times, that my heart and soul is behind you and your family to get the answers that you deserve. People like to say and use that term closure. I don't like that term because this will never be closed for you, whether you get the answers or you don't. It'll never be closed, and you'll never be able to understand it, but there need to be answers, and the more we can do to keep this case open and alive and cold so the resources can be there, we'll do. So thank you. I appreciate you coming on, and we'll keep working on this, and I will throw this out to some of my friends in the media, too, to get in touch with you to hopefully do some more press on this, because it certainly needs to be done.
I thank you, Dane, and my family is so gracious and humble towards you and the monkeys and everyone that continues. I read the boards all the time, and you have been so vigilant for her, and it truly is humbling, and we do thank you so much.
Drew, take care, my friend.
Bye-bye.
Now. Bye-bye. That's Drew Kessy, and I'll tell you, it's hard to believe 7 years that we've been covering this story, and it just chokes me up each time. And I did this as a commentary the other day, but I'll share this with you. This email came in from Drew the other day. He says, good morning, and happy New Year. Joyce, Logan, Katie, and myself want to reach out to all of you today on a special note. This upcoming January 24th, 2013, our daughter and sister, Jennifer Kessy, has been missing through the act of abduction for now 7 years. We don't think we need to tell people how long that is, let alone how long that feels in everyday life. We miss Jennifer tremendously and hold an unconditional love for her and great hope that someday soon we'll be able to bring her home to us, her family. It has been much too long for anyone to go through or have gone through this type of crime without knowing of what happened to her. It's our humble request that you have the opportunity or the ability or the power to mention Jennifer's abduction 7 years ago. We need your help badly in doing so. She's still in need of any and all help to try and figure out what happened to her that fateful day so long ago. Awareness is what is still needed, since there are some that think that Jennifer was found, that she has fallen by the wayside, or we simply have given up on her. Neither could be further from the truth. Please give Jennifer any chance you have to tell people about her case and that she is still missing. We wish you could tell you that the investigation was going in a positive direction. However, the truth is, although we are told that leads come into the police every day on a weekly basis, and they have great hope of solving Jennifer's case, that they are no closer to finding her than they were 7 years ago. That, my friends, hurts us to the very core, and why information eludes us, we have no idea. So in an effort to once again inform people that Jennifer is still missing, please, please, please mention her in any way you can. You hold the power of awareness she so desperately needs and deserves. We thank you all for sticking with us through this journey, for the help you've given Jennifer to date. You all play a very intricate part in helping us find Jennifer. Thank you for all you've done and hopefully continue to do, not only for Jennifer, but others who need media awareness with great respect and humility, Drew Joyce Logan and Katie Kessy. And Drew, you have my word. We'll keep doing what we can. That's it. That's tonight's show. If you know something about the Jennifer Kessy case, or you know someone in the media that will cover the Jennifer Kessy case, get that information to them as soon as you can. I'm Dana Pretzer. We'll see you again real soon.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.